Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Today with Peter Jan Marcuri from the University of Amsterdam, and we're here to talk about The Miracle of Amsterdam, your new book. So can we start out with you? Just tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? How did you come to this?
Well, indeed, I'm Dutch, but I was born in the south of the Netherlands, which is actually the Catholic part of the Netherlands, contrary to the northern part of the Netherlands, which is Protestant. And, well, strangely enough, I was born there, but I never experienced pilgrimages or Saint Cults or whatever. So it was only later when I started to study history in Amsterdam, University of Amsterdam, medieval history, that I encountered, well, Saint Cults and pilgrimages, and I was fascinated by that topic. Moreover, because I went traveling through Europe, and at one point I arrived in the south of France, where there is this famous shrine of Our Lady of Rocamadour, and I was there and I was flabbergasted. What was I seeing? I saw people going on their knees on a long stairs, along winding stairs, along this huge rock which stands up in the landscape. And well, you could maybe say in hindsight that that was my, well, ethnological sensation, that I was actually, I found it so fascinating what was happening there. I was wondering, what are these people doing there? What is so important to go on your knees on a stone stair for hundreds of meters up to this monastery over there? And so, I finished doing my research, and I started to work actually at the National Records Office in Amsterdam. And so I got really engaged in historical sources afterwards. And later on, I wanted to do more research, and I wanted to do more research on religious cultures. And I started doing my PhD when I was 40. And then I got a new job at the Meertens Institute in Amsterdam, which actually deals with popular culture, religious popular culture, and I was engaged there to execute a very vast long-term research project on pilgrimage culture. And later on, I got this additional position in ethnology as a professor at the University of Amsterdam. So actually, nowadays, I'm combining these two positions and, well, doing my job.
All right. Excellent. So this starts with a great story, The Miracle of Amsterdam. So could you, would you tell me about that? What happened?
Well, it's a great story, but it's also a little bit prosaic, because in those days, and then we're talking about the year 1345, when actually in mid-March this miracle happened. But, well, it was a miracle sort of dime a dozen, because in those years, or those centuries, even from the 13th till the 15th century in Europe, there were many such miracles as happened in Amsterdam, so-called Eucharistic miracles, miracles that happened to a host, as Catholics say. And what actually happened in Amsterdam was one of a kind, because they all look alike and they fit the, well, clerical strategy, as one may say, of those years to have some instruments to convince people to believe in actually in the transubstantiation of the host, which means that, well, Catholics believe that the host is being transubstantiated into real flesh and blood during the consecration in Mass. And also, well, nowadays people doubt that, but also in medieval times, there were also people and even priests who didn't believe that this really took place in a, well, in a theological way. And so many of these miracles were used to convince people about the authenticity of, well, religious practice and the things happening there. What happened in Amsterdam actually was a little slightly different, because there was in downtown Amsterdam of those years, there was a man lying on the bed. He was very sick. And people said, well, he needs to have the ultimate sacraments before he is going to die. So the priest was called upon and he brought him the host and he gave him the host. But the man was that sick that at one point he started to vomit. And his wife was in the room and seeing him starting to vomit, she came with a plate and she was able to catch the vomit. It's a little bit nasty story, but she did actually a very important thing, because the vomit with a host is actually sacred waste. And this sacred waste cannot be just thrown into the canals of Amsterdam, but you have to burn it ritually. And so she put it in the fireplace. And what happened the next day, all wood in the fireplace was burnt. Everything was burnt, but there was only this one still beautiful, white, shining host lying among the ashes. And that comes down to the miracle of Amsterdam.
That's miraculous, right? That's pretty amazing.
That's miraculous, we could say. If it really happened or not, we cannot say, because as I told you, there were hundreds of such kind of miracles happening throughout Europe in those years. And but in Amsterdam, they were so, well, convinced that it was a miracle that they, well, not yet actually directly convinced, they called upon the priest of Amsterdam, and they brought his host to this priest. But miraculously, for a second time, the host returned to the original house where the man lived. And this happened three times. And that's also a sort of topos-like story, that when things happen three times, it's the convincing ritual that the host or what happened there should really be there, and that this place was hallowed by God. And that, as a consequence, a chapel or a shrine should be built on that place, a place to venerate, and ultimately becoming a place of pilgrimage. I don't hear you.
All right, there I am. Sorry, I muted my mic. All right. So this isn't terribly common in the history of Amsterdam, though, right? This is a fairly unique incident in Amsterdam.
Well, this kind of miracles, they happen through Europe over three centuries for about 200 times. But in the Netherlands of those years, there were approximately 20 of such kind of miracles. But it doesn't necessarily mean that every miracle evolved into a big shrine or to a long history. But in the history of Amsterdam, there's actually only, well, in of those days, there's one miracle. And we can only, if we jump six centuries later, we can only encounter a new miracle happening, not with the Eucharist, but then we speak about 1945, so to say, at the end of the Second World War, when another miracle happened, or sort of miracle, and that was Mary, who was appearing before an Amsterdam lady. So actually in Amsterdam, we have two different shrines, one from the Middle Ages miracle host, and one, the 20th century, the apparition of Mary, the Lady of All Nations, as it's called.
All right, that's solid. Okay. Those are good miracles. All right. So tell me the parameters of your book. So you start with this 14th century miraculous event with the host, but it continues well into the 20th century, right?
So, yeah, absolutely. It's really that was actually the fascinating thing about this story, that it happened in 1345 and that it has been, contested throughout the centuries, because that's already more than six, seven centuries ago. And it has been continuously be contested, and there has been all kind of changes in history. We had the Reformation, we had the difficulty that Catholicism in the Netherlands was suppressed. We had a revivalism of Protestantism and antagonism against Catholicism in the 19th century. But it really survived through all these centuries. And then you really can become fascinated by the tenacity of cults, of the tenacity of the sacred. And that's something which is embedded in the cultural memory of people. And often you see that things disappear after the Reformation, but here in Amsterdam there was always a lineage which was kept by Catholics, and the cult itself was every time was reinvented into new forms, into new expressions, in order to help it survive and to bring the memory of this miracle to the present again. And that's what we did, because I did not only wrote this book, but I had my colleague Charles Kaspers, who took part for the medieval and early modern history. And so through the centuries, we have been describing how this, so to say, also contested miracle, this prosaic miracle, was able to mobilize 10,000, 100,000 of people throughout Europe, because in the Middle Ages it was really a European pilgrimage, place of pilgrimage, where nobility, royalty from all over Europe came to Amsterdam to invoke this sacred stead, this locus sacer, this holy place in Amsterdam, and to request for healing or all kind of support from above, so to say. And during the 17th century, after the Reformation, it became a very more local, little bit regional pilgrimage, enshrined in its own small environment, which was tolerated by the Protestants. And then we see again in the 19th century, when in the slipstream of the French Revolution, we also get our Dutch or so-called Batavian Revolution, then the suppression of the religious minorities was stopped, and the Catholics could take their own place in society again. But at that point, the Dutch society was seen as so Protestant that the Protestants actually could not allow again the Catholics to take this place fully and to have their devotions taken up again. And so a new fight evolved, actually harsher than ever before. And the Catholics were very suppressed not to practice their devotions and rituals in public. And that was a very contentious element in the whole devotion.
So methodologically, this is a cultural history of an object, yeah? And an idea?
Well, it's more an idea, because the object isn't there, actually. And that is also very interesting, because something we cannot imagine, because usually you have a cult object, which form a miraculous Marian statue, which remains and well, it decays a little bit. But here we have this host, and we have a very interesting letter from the Bishop of Utrecht, already from 2 years after the miracle in 1347, in which he says that if this miracle hosts gets dirty or is in decay or wilters, that the priest is allowed to, as much as possible, to bless a new host again. So probably there have been hundreds of miracle hosts. Every year a new miracle host was put inside of the shrine. And so, is there an object, yes or no? Because during the Reformation and the iconoclasm of 1566, the last one was demolished. So there is more this idea of the miracle, which is important in the history of this site.
And then this idea then represents, you can trace the history of the relationship between Catholicism and Protestantism, or the treatment of Catholicism in the Netherlands across time via the shrine. Is that fair to say?
That the book is about.
Yeah, I mean,
actually, what we try to do, because it's not one unidirectional relationship, because this miracle, or let's say the cultural consequences of the miracle that happened, are of a political kind, of an economical kind, of a cultural kind, of a social kind, and so we try to bring in the whole network of processes which were a result of this miracle into the history of Amsterdam, the history of the Netherlands, and to a certain extent in the medieval times, the history of Europe. And so I think we have a very multi-directional cultural history of the consequences of this miracle, which happened in 1345. So the miracle in itself is not in itself important. It is important that this idea came into being, but what was the result of that is really enormous. And from a modern perspective, you can hardly imagine how vast the influence of this miracle host was to Dutch and European history.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, because miraculous devotion, I mean, that's the thing with this, with these pilgrimages, with these sites, these locations where the slippage between the, you know, the physical and the spiritual worlds kind of exist. That's a fascinating thing. Okay, so do you mind going through the book kind of chapter by chapter and just giving me a brief summary? All right, so your introduction, I think you've covered with the miracle. Tell me about chapter one, the religious context in the Eucharist.
Well, I've been talking a little bit that we try to contextualize this miracle of Amsterdam, which maybe for Amsterdam is unique, which is not unique in a European perspective, because as I told you before that during the 13th to 16th century, there were approximately 200 of such miracle hosts, Eucharistic miracles, I must say, in Europe. And so it fits in that pattern. And the pattern is in itself interesting, but Amsterdam has its own historical development, the development out of it. And that's what the first chapter is about. And this first chapter also describes the different variations to the story of the miracle, because there are many variations to that. And also it tells about the initial expansion under the rulers of the House of Burgundy. And that's the development of the shrine in medieval times, which has also an important element into it, because the host didn't burn in 1345, but actually there was a second miracle of Amsterdam, because when the fame of that miracle became so big, people started to build. They destroyed the house where the man was living. If he died or not, well, we do not know, because the sources are not so full of that. And so they built a shrine, a very nice pilgrimage chapel on that site. In 1452, because, well, Amsterdam was full of wooden houses, a huge fire burned down half of the city, including the Chapel of the Miracle, the Holy Stead. And miraculously again, the host didn't burn again. So the full chapel was burned down, but in one corner, the miracle again survived. And so this was seen as a sort of confirmation of the initial miracle. And after that, the pilgrimages took up speed again and became even more known throughout Europe, which led to the new rulers of the Netherlands and the Habsburg House to come and visit more often the newly built shrine with this newly built big chapel of the Holy Stead. And this Holy Stead was a very, if you compare it to other pilgrimage places, a very big, beautiful chapel. It was called then the Eighth World Miracle, because it was so big and so full of silver and gold and all kind of presents which were brought by royalty and the simple pilgrims as well. And so it was one of the most important places of the whole town.
All right. So in chapter 2, in the Habsburgs' favor, you talk more about the Habsburgs and their interaction with the city, with the miracle, and Amsterdam itself.
Indeed. So I was actually combining.
Absolutely. All right. And then we move into the third chapter when you talk about the 17th and 18th century. It's called The Miracle on the Margins. What happens there?
Yeah, it's called On the Margins because, well, we all know that in 1566 we had this iconoclasm, fury going through the Low Countries, in which all chapels and churches were iconoclast. But unfortunately, because the gender issues are important also in relation to the Amsterdam miracle, there were the Amsterdam women who were so strong and important that they were able to defend the Holy Stead Miracle Chapel against the people who want to iconoclast the chapel. And so it is only after 1578, the end of the 16th century, when Amsterdam went over to Protestantism. So Catholicism was formally forbidden from that time on. The chapel of the Holy Stead was closed. It was desecrated, and it later became a Protestant church in itself. It meant that for the Catholics, they were orphaned from their own churches, and there was only one remaining isle of Catholicism in Amsterdam left, and that was the Beginnage. And the Beginnage, which was encircled in a sort of enclosure of houses, and inside of that Beginnage, a new priest for Amsterdam, Leonardus Marius, took his seat and tried to reorganize Catholicism after the Reformation for the remaining Catholic population of Amsterdam. Approximately 30% of the Amsterdam population remained Protestant after the Reformation. And he was able to change two or three houses of the Beginnage into a conventicle church, a hidden church. And in this church, he was able to re-establish, as it was called, the new Holy Stead. So actually the shrine of the medieval host was transferred from the place which was desecrated to the beguinage. And so, due to the Reformation in general, Catholics weren't able or allowed to practice their devotion in public or to have pilgrimages come to Amsterdam. That was all, so to say, illegal. And it became a very marginalized devotion, which was actually more or less practiced by, Catholic inhabitants of Amsterdam and Catholics from the surrounding area. But anyhow, the Catholics were able to continue their devotion. It wasn't cut. One of the important elements related to that was that the ritual of the procession was kept. During the medieval period, one of the expressions of devotions for the Amsterdam miracle was an additional sacramental procession, a procession of the Holy Sacrament. And it was the biggest of the whole town, because there were more processions, of course, but this one was the biggest, in which the whole town was united, and it was always done around mid-March. And the route of this procession, which really encircled the whole town through some streets, was kept in the collective memory. And what was important for the suppressed Catholics after the Reformation is that they wanted to continue with the most important veneration practice for the miracle, and that was this procession. So what they could do, they couldn't do, of course, after the Reformation, any processions anymore, but they did it individually. Did Catholics, they walked the route, the track of the procession through town, and they did that around mid-March again every year, possibly on their bare feet, because it was even more better to do it in this way with more veneration. And individually they walked this procession, and this was kept on for years and centuries until the 19th century. And so in this way, the Catholics they were able to keep to this very important miracle for their community. Also because they had to reunite themselves again as a community, and this was a sort of, a sort of reference point from their glorious history, from the glorious medieval times, to keep in mind and to keep that as a point of reference for them for the future as well. And so this miracle was an instrument to keep faith, to keep well connected and community, and to reorganize themselves as against the dominating Protestant culture.
One of the arguments I think you make very well that I really enjoy is the idea that this is so symbolic, and this becomes this important rallying point, or just a point for the residents of Amsterdam to remember their Catholicism, that becomes this very important locus for devotion, which is kind of fascinating. And then that it's in the kind of hidden away, at the beginning, doesn't seem to cause any problems. I was curious as I was reading, and I remain curious about how secret is this? If in mid-March I see someone walking barefoot around town in this known procession, right? I'm going to know, right? The authorities are going to know what is happening. Yeah. So it seems like this is a fairly public, silent devotion. Yeah?
You're absolutely right. It wasn't secret, but you weren't allowed as a Catholic to show your symbolic of Catholicism. So you couldn't show your rosary in your hand. You couldn't walk with a banner in your hand. You couldn't sing or pray Catholic songs or prayers in public. So, but they couldn't stop people walking barefoot, and they couldn't stop people walking around. So there was a sort of common knowledge about what was happening. And there were many conventicle churches in Amsterdam, hidden churches. And of course, initially they did it a little bit in secrecy. But at some point, people have to live together. there was a large remaining Catholic community. You couldn't leave it outside because there were many important merchants also among them. So as a sort of cohabitation, you needed Catholics, and the Catholics needed the Protestants as well. So they let themselves go to a large extent. So there was this idea also which exists about the Dutch or about Amsterdam, a high level of tolerance. So people knew that they were singing and praying, and they knew that they were walking around. But what they didn't tolerate at that moment is that some of the Catholics, they wanted to go because the old medieval shrine was still standing here. There was now a Protestant church. What they didn't allow was that during service in the Protestant church, Catholics went into it and started praying at the former place where the holy miracle was found in the fireplace. And even during service of the Protestant, they tried to take out some little stones and relics of the place where the fireplace has been. And that was a step too far. And then Protestants just, they took action and they kicked them out again. But as long as they didn't publicly all kind of things, then there was no problem. But within the beginning, that was a closed community of buildings, and so that has a large interior terrain. There they could do little ritualities and singing and praying, because that was inside a private space. And yeah, as long as it was public, then it wasn't a problem.
Yeah, the beginnage in Amsterdam is, this very closed. There's a courtyard, there are buildings that surround a courtyard, and all windows. You can see the buildings, but all the doors are on the inside. It's this very closed kind of secret space.
There's only a gate to which you can enter it. So it's, yeah. And they can close the gate, and that's what they did then. And then they had their own practices there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a, this is a very important part of kind of the Dutch identity, and particularly Amsterdam, kind of construction of Amsterdam, is this idea of tolerance. And I mean, that's one of the pillars of Dutchness, right? So in chapter 5, you kind of move from a Catholic identity to a national. It's called The Silent Walk is a National Symbol of Identity. Would you like to comment on that for me?
Yeah, because... Well, important thing is maybe because that connects to chapter 4, because the Dutch Revolution, in which all religions were equal again and they were allowed to do everything they wanted, the Protestants had become so wary about the Catholics. And because about ultramontanism and the role of the popes and the Jesuits, Protestants saw all kinds of conspiracies around them, that now with this liberty of religion in the Netherlands, Catholics would take over actually the Netherlands and would, with the help of Jesuits and Rome, take over the country and wipe out Protestantism. So they became contrary to the ecumenism and the tolerance of the 17th, 18th century. In the 19th century, due to these conspiracy ideas and so on, there became a very strong antagonism between Protestants and Catholicism. And so it led even to a constitutional ban on processions, because Catholics thought, well, now we are free to practice our religion again, so we start also doing processions, also a bridge too far. And then the Protestants said, no, you may only do something inside your own churches. And they were so wary that they even put a constitutional ban on processions. And its constitutional ban on processions remained even until 1983 in the Dutch constitution. So that explains a little bit the difficulty on public rituality and the antagonism between Protestants and Catholics in the 19th century. And so why I'm telling you this, because at one point, Catholics said, what can we do now? Because we have freedom of religion, and but we are still such a, to a certain extent, scattered community throughout the Netherlands. In the south, a little bit more was more a majority, but in the northern parts, minorities. And we want to become, well, Catholics at large in the Netherlands as a real community. We want to find ourselves and to emancipate, because we have been suppressed for two decades by the Protestants. So we want to become full citizens again. But full citizenship and relation actually meant for them also very important to practice processions and even funeral processions, which were not allowed, etc. And so they did something clever. They called back upon the tradition, and they knew, and now we're talking about the end of the 19th century, 1881, to lay young Catholics. They recalled that during the 17th, 18th century, people were reenacting individually these medieval processions. The thing we talked about, that they on the barefoot, or they just did it individually because that was allowed. And they said, well, maybe if we take that tradition as a starting point, and maybe we can turn that individual rituality into a sort of collective new ritual. And maybe that might give an impetus and maybe an incentive to the importance and to the revival of the devotion to the miracle of Amsterdam. And so what they did, they started initially with 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people, started walking again in a little group, this same route of the medieval procession. And then at some point, people found that a splendid idea, and they were motivated by it. It was also a time in which the emancipation of Catholics took up speed a bit again, and that they really found it important to try to do a revival of the medieval devotion. So everywhere in the country, people were thinking about how can we take up this Marian devotion from high low again, because that also disappeared during the Reformation. And so in this whole dynamics of emancipatory behavior of the Catholics in the second half of the 19th century, this was a sort of, yeah, at some point people thought, well, maybe in the capital of the Netherlands, it's symbolically so important to have this devotion, which was known throughout Europe in the Middle Ages, to revive it again and to use it as an instrument for our further emancipation and about uniting Dutch, the Dutch Catholica, the Dutch Catholics. And so within two decades from a group of four people, it grew into a national movement of 10,000 of people who came to Amsterdam to walk all collectively together this route of the former processions, but do it all because we had this ban on processions, so they had to do it quiet. They had to do it without any symbolic, any visual symbolics. So, and they had to do it during the night, because they were still initially afraid if they would do this during the day that it would offend the Protestants, and that maybe with some police force it might be stopped. And so slowly, from 1881 till the beginning of the 1900s, it grew slowly from a very small movement into a huge movement. And at some point, even 90,000 people, 90,000 Catholics came from all over the Netherlands in the night. So they walked from 12 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock in the morning, with extra trains, with buses and so on. It was a huge operation to bring all these people from one night from all over the country to Amsterdam. And so, because you asked me what's the national, and it's actually this became the only real national pilgrimage for the Dutch Catholics at large. and it was in the capital, but it was also done in a Dutch way, because it was not only a devotional ritual, but it was actually also a movement of protest, because they walked there, but they did it silently, and this silent walking was actually also this implicit protest of the idea that we cannot have any processions because there is this constitutional ban and we are still secondary citizens of the Netherlands. And so it grew and became, well, of course, very well known as a sort of as a devotional movement, but also as an as a movement of protest.
So can you tell me what happens during the war? Is there are there these processions during World War II?
Well, during the war, initially, the first war year in 1941, there was no problem, but the rest of the war until 1945, the Germans did not allow to walk this collective silent walk, as it is called. Initially, people did it in the old-fashioned way to do it individually, in pairs or with in small groups. But later on, it became more and more dangerous to do it in larger groups. But there were still some people who, until the end of the war, tried to not to lose this tradition, because it has always been practiced, sometimes with very little quantities. Also, beginning of the 19th century, were only a few Catholics who remembered it to do it, and also people said this tradition of every year doing the remembrance of the procession and in honor of the miracle, we should keep it. So during the war, there was also some people who really kept the line unbroken.
No, go ahead, please.
Well, maybe important to say is that this silent walk, as it was called, was actually a practice of men, and it was only that in the 1960s that women were officially allowed to participate, and that has to do is also a famed or an infamed element of Amsterdam culture, is that already in the 19th century, when this silent walk started, it had to follow the course of the medieval procession. But the medieval procession, these streets went through the red light district of Amsterdam, which is now the red light district, but also in the 19th century it was. And then it was regarded as unthinkable that women would go during the night, because it was a nightly silent walk, that they would, well, participate in such a procession going through the red light district. And so, which doesn't imply that there weren't any women, because there were many, but there were always some dozens of women who wanted to go along and just disobey the orders of the priest and the organizers, and it's only until the beginning of the 1950s that there is specific silent walk for women was instituted, which didn't start at night but which start early in the morning. So for the women, they could start at 7 o'clock on Sunday morning, so walk in daylight on the quiet Sunday morning through these streets. And it's only, as I said, in the 1960s that it was allowed by the organizers, after the Cultural Revolution, of course, to have jointly do this silent walk.
That's such a great, I love that part of this this whole story, with the idea that this procession goes through Dvala now, right? Like right through the red light district.
Have you seen it once?
No, I've never seen the procession. Okay. I'm very excited. I'm going to watch for it next year.
I deliberately do not use the word procession because it's okay. So because it it could not be a procession, and it was not allowed to be a procession. So then the word use of the word procession is confusing, so to say. That's why I use the word silent walk. And I know that in English it's ambiguous, the word, but in Dutch when you use procession, you always think about a religious procession, which it.
Yeah, I mean, in a Catholic context, even in English, that makes sense, right? A procession is an event in a way, yeah, that a walk, you know,
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
There's fanfare to procession.
Yeah.
So actually, this takes us well into Chapter 6, Revolution and the Reinvention of Tradition, starting in 1960 to 2015. So tell me what happens in Chapter 6.
Well, in Chapter 6, then, of course, the long 1960s, what do we all know about the long 1960s? We have a cultural revolution, B generation, but also there is a religious revolution. So the religious institutions are debated, are standing under pressure, and especially the Council also for the Catholic Church, and more in particular, in the Netherlands, because the Netherlands always were very devout Catholics, because they were very attached to Rome, and they were very ultramontane, as it is called, connected to the policy of Rome. But as deep devout as they were before the 1960s, after the religious and cultural revolution of those years, they became the most liberal, and the decay of Catholicism has become one of the strongest in the Netherlands, and also the new ideas of how to practice Catholicism also made Rome very wary about the new Dutch catechism and so on. They were very was very infamous, and whatever. So but that also meant that the institutional church decayed very much, but also all practices and devotions connected to it. The Second Vatican Council also had a sort of depreciating attitude towards devotions, which were called medieval and whatever. And that was really very much expressed also in the Dutch media, and mediated, and even Catholic priests, they thought they professed that it was all from another age and era, and that we shouldn't do that anymore. So that affected very much also the silent walk, which diminished from in the late 1950s from 90,000 people a year to 6,000-7,000 a year in the beginning of the 1970s. And so it became a sort of waning devotion, and everyone in those years said, well, maybe another 10-20 years, but then we're done with the silent walk. But miraculously, one could say, it's still here and still to go, and we still have a yearly, what shall we say, 4,000-5,000 people who participate in it. It's still a little bit diminishing, so we still have to see, but well, it has overcome many contestations, many periods of decay or suppression and so on. So there is still this private organization, the Society of the Silent Walk, as it is called, and they still organize every year this silent walk. And maybe ironically, one of the major threats is maybe the popularity of Amsterdam as a tourist destination. Because, well, we know all these stories about the pressure of over-tourism and so on. But nowadays, even at night, at midnight, after 12 o'clock, when you go to the streets in mid-March, which is not a very, very, well, touristic or warm season, it's often quite wet and cold and so on. But then the streets at night are filled, and these small medieval streets, they they are filled with people, tourists walking with their luggage. They are drinking, standing in groups, smoking weed or whatever, and it's often practically very difficult for the silent procession to pass by. And also because they are not alone anymore in the streets, in their, well, meditative isolation, so to say, the whole experience of doing the silent walk, being confronted so directly with people who are drinking and shouting and yelling because they do not understand what these mute, silent walking people doing there, a little bit old-fashionedly dressed and so on. So there is this culture, you could say a sort of small culture war between tourists, the excesses of tourism and the still devout people who are, who find each other at midnight in these red light area districts of Amsterdam. And so last year, for the first time, the organization was obliged to set in, people who take care for the order, but they also, there was a spontaneous initiative from the bar owners of those streets. And they said, well, we have respect for this tradition. We see the difficulty about combining tourism and this kind of devout rituality. And the bar owners had a sort of, policing task, and they hired people to keep people at distance, the people who are frequenting the bar to keep them inside or not too much on the street. And so maybe, this is a little counterweight against the over-tourism Amsterdam is confronted with nowadays. So what the future will bring, we don't know. I don't have a glass bulb, so I cannot say, but this is the present day situation.
That would be ironic, right, though, if we had this procession that's lasted 650 years, survived the excesses of the Reformation, only to be killed by drunken bro tourists in Amsterdam in the 21st century. That doesn't bear thinking.
It's interesting because also UNESCO wants to propagate world cultural heritage, but also intangible cultural heritage. And by trying to protect intangible cultural heritage, because I advised also the Society of the Silent March, please do not go for an accreditation for the UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage National List, because if you get on it, it gets worse. And that's what you see what's happening in Venice, and in this Venice of the North is happening as well, that where it's cherished for is actually also being brought down by the people who want to see all these wonders.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem, I mean, the tourism is just it's destructive. But at the same time, I understand why the world wants to see Amsterdam, right? It's a great city.
Absolutely. And why we want to see Venice.
Yes. Yeah, I'm also a nice place. Okay, so how do you end this book? Chapter 7, Conflict or Consensus? How do we conclude?
Well, it's a book over such a long period with so many threads in it connecting economy, social life, politics, whatever is connected to this miracle, and it's difficult to oversee it. Also, we want to have a sort of final wrapping up, and also because there has been so much contestation, and we wanted to make clear that actually it's nowadays it's more about consensus than about contestation, and maybe if we talk about tourism, that's all also a contestative element. But if we look at the rituality itself, we see that in the last decades, maybe also a little bit ironically, that they have been trying to involve Protestants, but also Jews, but also non-believers, or New Age people, to connect to the silent walk, because the silent walk actually is not so much a Catholic ritual, but it's a meditative ritual in silence to which everyone can connect quite easily. And so there have been some ecumenistic silent walks in the past year, and it actually brings out, it advocates now consensus and tolerance and as religious people going walking together towards the future. And maybe if we have time, then there is another important element to connected to the silent walk, because well, we have been talking about this century-old history and the necessity to reinvent it every time. There were also very important reinventions in another way since the Second World War, because this idea of walking in silence without any objects, without any symbolic, is a very strong ritual. And after the Second World War, in the religiously then still so divided Dutch society between Protestants and Catholics, they were looking for what could be a proper ritual to commemorate the victims of the Second World War. And it was difficult to find something in which both parties could find themselves together. And then one of the main men of the Society of the Silent Walk, he was asked in this committee to try to make something up. And he proposed to do also a silent walk, still a tocht, for the commemoration of the victims of the Second World War. And actually inspired on this centuries-old ritual, a new national ritual for combined Protestants, all denominations could be included in that. A new ritual was invented, and which is now yearly, every day on the 4th of May, when we commemorate our victims of World War, in every municipality of Amsterdam, a stille tocht, a silent walk again, is held to commemorate the victims. And it not only ended with that ritual, because later on, at the end of the 20th century, there was again a sort of silent walk as a new reinvention was put on the ritual map. And that was because, as we have seen elsewhere in Europe, that the commemoration of individual victims in society due to traffic victims, hey, young people who died, or after traumatic events, or after big disasters, there's also a need to commemorate the victims. And in the Netherlands, specifically in the 1990s, also a silent walk was different from the Catholic one, so to say. But actually, when you look at them, they are not so very different. But the intention is different. The background is different. Silent walks are now a part of the ritual repertoire of the Netherlands after traumatic death and the commemoration of victims. And so, during the year, at least, dozens of stille tochten of such silent walks for after traumatic death are held throughout the Netherlands. And we have exported this product because you find them also now in other countries.
That's fascinating. Wow, that's really cool. The connection of Remembrance Day and the silent walk, of course, right? And that's fantastic. So interesting. All right. So I've taken up a whole bunch of your time here. We've been talking for over an hour. But is there anything else you wanna say? Is there anything that we need to know? Is there something we haven't covered?
Well, you had a list of questions, but I think we were.
No, I think we've gotten through it pretty much.
Yeah.
We've touched on everything I wanted to talk about.
New project you had yet in somewhere?
Oh, yeah. No, I would love to hear that. What are you doing next? Oh. So, yeah, what are you working on now?
What I'm working on now? Well, this book is already, it's now just published in English, but my research has been done for some years. But now I'm actually working at something, well, it has some connection, but it's on alternative healing practices. And it's a little bit a taboo subject, and it's not because I'm doing it myself, because I encountered here in Amsterdam, even among well-educated people, among friends of myself during the last year, that people are increasingly doing alternative healing practices, and we have a very active anti-quack movement. They are very strong and very activist. And so people do not want to talk about it a little bit. It's a little bit taboo in the Netherlands. So I thought, well, nobody is touching this subject, not from a medical point of view, because that's not my field, of course, but from a cultural point of view. So I want to know why and how they do it and what kind of practices there are. So I started a research project on alternative healing. I have many interns here. I've just written a book in Dutch about sort of for the wider audience how to look from a cultural perspective to alternative healing practices. It resulted directly that the anti-quack movement got down on my neck and said, what the heck is professor from the university doing with alternative healing? Because when they see the word only, they react and they don't see that it is not that I'm not advocating it, I'm not rejecting it, I'm just looking from a cultural perspective to that thing. Well, that's one thing. Another thing is that I'm starting up it's not a project, but there is a need for a new handbook for students on ethnology, my field, so to say, European ethnology. And so this is another book what I'm starting to write now.
Okay, just a couple small projects then. No problem. You know, that's so funny. And we'll edit this out of the conversation because I'd be embarrassed. I go to an acupuncturist and I get myofascial release. And, you know, I have a PhD. Like, it's ridiculous. And I know it doesn't help, but I just feel better. I don't know. I had a student this semester who wrote about the divine feminine and how there's this co-opting of feminine ideals and Wicca and it's all about weight loss. It's all very, it's a bizarre kind of unholy marriage there. They think it really affects women in particular. That's so cool.
All right. The important thing is that for so many people it works, and the anti-quack movement is so pushy because as soon as someone deals with it, they try to put him or her down and even me, there were articles in the newspapers, accusing me of all kind of things. It's so stupid. But on the other hand, there are so many aspects which have a good outcome. So you shouldn't be so monoman looking at healing practices as they do. So.
I mean, there is another gendered issue there, that, right? Like, we accept anything that you can prove that white guys in lab coats can prove is truth. And anything else, you know, that like 1,000 years of people doing it unofficially, that's not provable. That's not scientific method. It's interesting.
If that's a gender issue, I don't know. I think it's made more of a sort of West, not where, non-West position.
Yeah. More. Yeah, and it's about authority and regulation and legalism. Yeah. And I'm definitely inclined to look at everything from a gendered perspective, but yeah, good point. All right. So let me finish up here officially. We'll cut back here. So thank you very much. The book is The Miracle of Amsterdam, Biography of a Contested Devotion, out in English from the University of Notre Dame Press and from Notre Dame, Indiana. I believe it's available now or soon.
Absolutely.
It's a really enjoyable read, as well as everything else. It's well researched. It's an excellent book. It's really fun to read. I enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you. I